And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Usry, and I'm pleased to welcome Alexandria Marzano-Lesnovich to the program today. Alexandria has received fellowships from the National Endowment for the Arts, McDowell and Yaddo, as well as a Rona Jaffe Award. She also teaches at Grub Street and Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Today we'll be talking about her book, The Fact of a Body, A Murder and a Memoir, and a listener's advisory. The book does deal with difficult themes like murder and child abuse, so caution is advised. Alexandria, in the book's prologue, you begin with the discussion of the legal concept of proximal cause. Who is Helen Paulsgraf, and what role did she play in defining this concept of proximal cause?
So Helen Paulsgraf is the Paulsgraf in the case Paulsgraf versus Long Island Railroad Company. And that's the case that gave us the idea of proximate cause. Interestingly, it wasn't in the case decision. It was actually in a dissent. But that concept turned out to have sort of a lot of influence over the law. Although, as I say in the book, interestingly, not in the criminal law. So Helen Paulsgraf was waiting for the train one day. She was going to take her two little girls to Rockaway Beach for the afternoon. Through a convoluted series of events that I sort of go into at the start of the book, let's just say for now that she was injured. And the question became in the court, when did this injury start? Because how you tell the story of how the injury came about means determining the cause of the injury. So in this case, there was a young man running late for the train. He had a package under his arm, a wrapped package, so it was not clear what was inside it. He was running for the train. He leapt for the train. And the porter kind of pushed him. Someone leaned off the train and helped pull him aboard. So they helped him get up on the train. But in the process, the package fell. It turned out to contain fireworks, and the package exploded. And then Helen Paulsgraf was standing on the other end of the train platform. And this big metal thing she was standing under fell. When you look up online animations of the case, because the case is taught in law schools to teach this idea of proximate cause, the concept being there are many causes in fact, many things in fact caused this, but proximate cause is the one that the law says is the real cause, the one that sort of caused the injury. When you look these animations up online, Helen Paulsgraf is squashed in the animations. The thing teeters and it falls down on Helen Paulsgraf and squashes her. That's not what happened, actually. There's actually some debate whether Helen Paulsgraf was even injured. There doesn't seem to have really been any evidence of that. She claimed mental distress from this accident. But the court actually said, okay, well, we'll assume she was injured to reach the more interesting question, legally, of what caused this injury. And so in the dissent, you have this idea of, well, there are all these different causes in fact, but what we have to pay attention to is the proximate cause, the one that the law says truly matters. And so I began the book by telling that story because I wanted to get at a couple of things. I wanted to get at the idea that cause and how we understand cause is linked to where we start a story. We can tell a story many different ways, but how we start determines how we understand cause. I teach creative writing pretty often, and I have had the chance the last couple of years to teach a class on book writing. And we often talk about memoir structure. And what I try to tell the students and what I sort of realized in the writing of my own book is that where you put events in your life on the narrative arc determines how the reader thinks about their relationship and cause, determines how the reader interprets them. If they're coming at the third, fourth, the four-fifths mark, they're the climax of the book, and they're why we were reading this. We were reading it to get to that. But if they come at the start of the book, it's kind of the inciting incident. It's the thing that kicks off the trouble, and they have different meanings. And I think with the Paulsgraf story, you know, if I put the emphasis on the porter, then the cause is sort of one understanding. If I put the emphasis on the young man running late for the train, the cause is another understanding. If I put the emphasis on where Helen Paulsgraf was standing, that has a different emphasis. And the idea is that to understand cause, you have to look at how you're telling the story. And so that's one of the reasons I started the book that way. Another reason is that it's a book that works very much on imagining the characters inside legal files. One of the things that struck me very strongly when I was in law school was the way that every case you're reading is really about people. It's really a story about people. And I wanted to highlight that. So I sort of, right away in the book, asked the reader to imagine someone from a legal story. And lastly, the reason I did that was because in criminal law, we don't have an idea of proximate cause. We don't really care what the proximate cause is in criminal law. And yet, when we think of how we judge someone who has committed criminal acts, how the story that we ourselves tell ourselves about cause is absolutely vital to how we judge them, how we understand them.
The theory that nothing happens in a vacuum.
Absolutely.
There's always a preceding chain of events leading up to any incident. And the murder from the title of your book takes place in February of 1992 near this little town of Ioway, Louisiana. And who was Jeremy Guillory?
Jeremy Guillory was the little boy who Ricky Joseph Langley strangled. And Jeremy Guillory was living with his mother, Lorelei Guillory. They had this house, the first home of their own that Lorelei had rented for them. And yet that winter was a bit of a rough one. They couldn't keep the heat on. And so she had moved them to stay with friends of hers. And this question of cause, right? The friends had a two-year-old baby. And that day that Jeremy got home from kindergarten, that sort of fateful day, the baby was wailing. And Jeremy asked Lorelei Guillory, his mother, for his favorite BB gun and decided to run out the house and begin to go play. So the baby wanted to play with him, but the baby was yelling. And like many little boys, right? He wanted to get away. He wanted to go play with his friends. He wanted to be out in the woods, maybe. And so she gave him the BB gun. He ran out the door. He ran to his friend Joey's house. He played with two children in that house, Joey and the little girl I call June. And so he was looking for them to play with, but they weren't home. The lodger in the house was. And Ricky Joseph Langley was the lodger. He answered the door, and he strangled Jeremy Guillory.
Where they live in this neighborhood, the street doesn't even have an official name. And that seems kind of like such a potent metaphor for so many people in this part of the story, that they're on the periphery of society.
Absolutely. It really struck me that part of what took the police a while to respond to was just that they couldn't figure out where the house was and whose responsibility the house fell into, whose area it fell into. In fact, Ricky Langley was the one who called the police back, who called 911 again to try to give them directions to the house.
And Ricky Langley, through the course of the book, we learn more about his life and his parents' life before he was born. And he just seems like a soul who never had a chance at a happy life. What was the sense of tragedy he was actually born into? There was like a very immediate tragedy in his family's life.
There was a very immediate tragedy. And I'm really struck by your statement that it seems like the road not having a name was sort of a metaphor for all these people not having, I think, a place to get help with what was happening. And this particular tragedy that kind of, if we want to think about cause, in some ways started it all. In some ways, there are many ways you can tell the story. Was one such example where it just felt like so many things went wrong. So Ricky's parents were Bessie and Alcide. They were high school sweethearts. They did not go to high school together, but they were high school sweethearts in that age. By the time they were in their early 20s, they had five children. They had gone out to California to try to sort of start a new life out there, to leave Louisiana, where Alcide had grown up and where Bessie had moved as a teenager. They decided to go out to California together and kind of start this new life. Their first child, Oscar, was born before they left Louisiana. And then the other children, four of them, were born in California. And Alcide lost his job where he was working in California. And so they were on their way back from California to Louisiana when they were in this horrific car crash in Arizona, just this absolutely horrific crash. And this is another case where the story was told many different ways, the cause of the crash. One of the things that really struck me when you think about storytelling in a situation like this, where we're making stories out of the past, which is so much what this book is about, is that even something as simple as did the crash occur at night or did the crash occur during the day was told different ways at the trials and in the newspaper articles. And so there was this horrific crash. It killed two of the children, the baby Vicky and the eldest son, Oscar, and landed his mother, Bessie, Ricky's mother. This was before he was conceived, but it landed his mother in a full body cast. She was enclosed in plaster from her chest to her ankles. Her legs were fixed blade open. There was a hole for body waste exit, and there was a bar between her ankles that the orderlies could pull on to move her. When she was in that cast for quite a number of months, they realized that she was pregnant. She had become pregnant inside the cast. And that pregnancy was Ricky Langley.
And so there are all these horrible echoes that happen through the story because of this later, after the murder, Mr. Lawson, who had had Ricky as a lodger in the house, he and his wife, dies in a horrific crash himself.
He does. And how to understand that crash is still very, very much open to debate. So I think something that's important to know is when Jeremy Guillory's body was found, and how it was found was that actually that Ricky Langley led the police to the body, to where he'd hidden the body in the closet. The body had been in the Lawson house for 3 days in an upstairs bedroom in that closet. And there was a pubic hair on Jeremy Guillory's lip that did not match Ricky Langley. And then several months later, the father in that family, who I've called Terry Lawson, died, and so did the son, whom I've called Joey Lawson. Terry Lawson was riding a motorcycle. His son Joey was holding on to him from behind. And they hit the second car of an Amtrak train and were thrown off from the train with such velocity that the train conductor never actually realized he'd hit anything at all, or rather that something had hit the train. And they were thrown off and died instantly. And that question of the second car of an Amtrak train. I've been out to that crossing. It is just incredibly clear. The sky is wide. The sun's right there. There aren't even any bushy trees too close in. Only one house, not very close by at all. You can see for miles, basically. And yet, they died in this accident. And the question is, why?
One of the possible interpretations is guilt. But we have to wonder, guilt for what? Guilt for bringing in Ricky Langley into the home and this horrible thing happening, or perhaps something else?
Exactly, exactly, exactly. And I think, you know, we'll never know. There was briefly an attempt to exhume Terry Lawson and have the hair that was on Jeremy's lip tested against him. That attempt was met with a lot of, I think rightfully, maybe outrage and sort of disgust. Ricky Langley had already confessed to the murder, so why did it seem like people were trying to dig around the past and trying to understand this? And yet this was sort of never resolved. And I think for me what it really meant, because honestly I have no idea what happened, but I found it so potent that the second car of the Amtrak train, and how do we understand that? You know, how do you understand hitting the second car? It's hard to hit the second car. And I think, again, one of the reasons I found it so potent is just this idea of we don't know what stories are happening in each other's families. We don't know what's going on behind closed doors. In this case, behind closed doors, we had a child's body hidden for 3 days. And the question of who knew what and how do we understand that? And how do we understand that the mother in that family disappeared afterwards? You know, they had to really track her down for the second trial. Does that mean anything? And does it mean anything to how we tell the story? And I think in my own case, I think I'm sure one of the reasons I was drawn to this question was just that there were things happening behind closed doors. You know, in my case, the person doing the molestation was my grandfather, and that was happening, you know, behind the secret shell of a family, you know, in the private sphere that we don't normally talk about. And this is a case in which the public sphere, the stranger to the family, Ricky Langley, the lodger that people thought was a bit strange, he was certainly the one who had committed the murder, but it seems like the story is more complicated here in ways that we don't know and we can't know because we can't see behind closed doors.
As you've just mentioned, there are more crimes in this book than just a murder.
Yes. The subtitle of the book is A Murder and a Memoir, and the story that the murder is interwoven with is the story of what happened in my own family, which was that I grew up with my grandfather molesting myself and my sisters. And I'll tell you, you just said, this isn't the only crime in the book, the murder. I was very far into the book before I realized that what had happened in my own family was a crime. I was writing about it first through the lens of this abuse that I carried memories of in my body, and trying to look at Ricky Langley and trying to wrap my head around this child molester, and maybe in some ways looking at him because I don't have any records for my grandfather. The book is written off of some 30,000 pages of court records, and I have those records because Ricky Langley was caught. But my grandfather was never adjudicated, and I don't have any records. I have very little of a means to understand him or to try to wrap my head around him. And obviously these cases are in no way analogous, but because the way I found this story was that I had gone to Louisiana while I was in law school to help fight the death penalty, which is just very much what I wanted to do with my life. And I had encountered Ricky Langley's story and listened to him describe molesting children. And in that moment, though I wanted to help fight for his life, that was what I believed in, all my memories kind of came roaring back inside my body. Time collapsed for me. And I very much felt my grandfather's hands on me and felt all that was unresolved there. And for me, this quest to look at these stories became quite personal, but it started from this place of, oh, I carry this secret in my body. I carry these memories so vividly. It didn't start from a place of recognizing that there had been a crime in my family. And I think that goes to how we see child molestation, frankly. The laws we have around child molestation, sex offender registries, seem to be targeted at the strangers. And yet, as far as we can tell, the overwhelming majority of child abuse happens within families.
Ricky Langley's testimony about the crime and his life took on so many permutations over the years, and it was just in one instance that he said his father had abused him. So if we consider that to be definitive and that was the case, it's a terrible similarity that y'all shared, and to see how differently your lives turned out is profound in its way, that such different outcomes can come from that.
In so many ways, layering these two stories turned out to be a story about class and about opportunity. And I think that's visible even in the way that my grandfather wasn't seen as a criminal. And Ricky Langley, even before he killed Jeremy Guillory, was. And that has something to do with class. I'm not saying that he shouldn't have been seen as a criminal. He was a pedophile who was molesting children. Of course he should have been seen as a criminal. But there's something about who we allow ourselves to recognize as criminal and who we're willing to help. There's a moment in the book and a moment that I found in the records that really stayed with me. When Ricky Langley was a teenager, he seems to have tried to turn himself in and get help. And I think one of the things that that made me think about, and that I then was forced to think about with my own grandfather, was what was it like for these two people to live with the knowledge of who they were? And I will also, just to something you just said, I will also add that when I confronted my grandfather about molesting me, which I did as a teenager, and no one in my family had ever confronted him about the abuse, the way my family handled the abuse was to basically just never talk about it. And so when I went and confronted him, no one ever had. And what he said was, what happened to you is not such a terrible thing. It also happened to me. And I struggled with that for years. I just struggled with that. Because we have this cultural perception, I think, that people who molest are those who have been molested themselves. And as somebody who was molested, I'll just tell you, that was a really offensive idea to me growing up. It was painful. It made me feel doomed. It was something I really, really wrestled with. And something that I was interested to learn in the statistics just isn't true. And when he said that, I just felt so, how am I supposed to understand him? How much empathy am I required to have for the man who did this to me? And then when I saw that in Ricky Langley's story, that in this one moment he said it had happened. Other times he said it didn't, but in this one moment he said it had. I really think it's this question of how do we understand each other? And it goes back to this, what we started the interview by talking with, this idea of cause and how do we understand all the different things that go into your life and make you who you are. And I think one of the main reasons I needed to write this book was to wrap my head around a way to tell the story that didn't elide the pain that was done, but also acknowledged the pain that was done to these people, but then also didn't elide the pain that they had done, but then also, you know, didn't elide the pain. It's that constant back and forth of the way the story was constructed in my family. We were never allowed to say that my grandfather was a molester. We had to just act like he was just a loving grandfather, despite the knowledge our bodies held, despite the vividness of the memories, despite the hauntedness. And with Ricky Langley, the story was often told just he was a child molester, pedophile, murderer. I think people often didn't think about what had happened in his past. And I needed to tell a story where we don't deny the hurt, but we also don't deny the hurt that was done to people. It's sort of an argument for complexity in some ways.
You use the word haunted, and you were haunted in the corporeal sense that your grandfather is there and appearing to be a loving person in your life when the abuse isn't happening. And then Ricky was haunted in a more spectral sense in that he had visions of his dead older brother, Oscar, that seemed to frighten him, and he uses as perhaps a justification or at least an explanation on what happened with Jeremy Guillory.
Absolutely. And this, again, like everything else in the story, comes down to this question of how do you tell the story? And one of the things as a writer that I thought about in constructing this was that I had to give this very active narrator presence to the reader so that you could get the sense that the narrator was one mind struggling to put together the story. And that would also highlight that so often there were conflicting accounts. So with Ricky Langley being haunted by visions of Oscar Lee Langley, when he was a child, certainly his family all agrees that he would say that he saw Oscar Lee in places. In fact, in sixth grade, he walked up to the front of the classroom and wrote, "I am Oscar Lee Langley," on the classroom chalkboard. When I read that in the records, I had to sort of try to imagine what was it like for his mother, Bessie, to have received this call from the school asking, "Well, who's Oscar Lee Langley?" And being asked about her dead son. You know, it's quite painful, I think. I would imagine. And so as a child, he saw Oscar Lee Langley. And then for many years, he didn't mention seeing him again. He sort of never mentioned that again. There's no record of that in the files. And other people seem to agree that he never mentioned this. Until after the murder. And after the murder, he told the story so many different times. In fact, when he was in jail, awaiting trial, he would ask the detectives to come listen to him tell the story again. He would confess over and over again. And each time he confessed slightly differently. And I think the way I understand that is that he seems to have been so profoundly rocked by what he had done, by the realization of what he had done, the realization of who he was, that he needed to tell this story over and over again to try to understand it. And he told it many, many different ways. And I think two of the tellings that stayed with me most strikingly that happened both after and then sort of in the years to follow after the murder were, one, the telling in which he says that he strangled Jeremy Guillory in an effort not to molest him. And two, the telling in which he says that he strangled Jeremy Guillory thinking that he was strangling the ghost of Oscar Lee Langley and that he would finally free himself and his family from the hauntings of the past. And I think because I grew up in a family that was so haunted by almost a spectral idea of the past, this thing we couldn't talk about but that affected our interactions just all the time, that really resonated with me because it was sort of a literal rendering of the way the past infiltrates into families. And I think the past is sort of a hidden force in our lives, something that we don't always recognize when it's in front of us. And in this telling, it was like this spectral, it's strange to call a spectral thing more solidified, but personified, let's say.
Later, he volunteers to address a group of law enforcement workers about pedophilia and what is in the mind of a pedophile. And at that point, do you think he was searching for atonement, or was he searching for attention because it did not go as he wanted it to go?
I do think that there is a genuine desire on his part to help people understand pedophilia. What that ends up looking like, because he is a pedophile, and so when he starts talking about it, it does not have the effect I think he intends. I think he intends it to help people, but the actual effect, as happened in that seminar, is that people are quite creeped out. I'll tell you, I was quite creeped out reading the files. And that was such a strange moment in the case, because it's unknown whether the idea emerged with him, or it's unknown from the files anyway, I don't know, since this book was written off of these files, whether the idea emerged with him or whether the idea emerged with the defense team. I have to think that it emerged from a combination of the two, because it would be a truly peculiar thing for the defense team to sort of come up with. And yet it would also be truly peculiar for the defense team to just let him lead the way. So I think it emerged from the two, where he was going to address a group of corrections officers and kind of, quote unquote, explain the mind of a pedophile. Every time I tell this story, I see people's faces and their face starts to look like, well, that's not a good idea. Like, how could that possibly be a good idea? And sure enough, what happened was that in trying to speak very earnestly about the way that he saw children, he ended up horrifying people.
Because what it leads to, horrific acts. And those are things we can't understand.
And that's,
they're so beyond our conceptions of ourselves, I think.
They're so beyond. And I'll tell you, as somebody who was molested, this was simultaneously crucial for me to try to wrap my head around and also so, so painful to try to wrap my head around. And one of the things that was really important to me in this book, I hope that readers experience it sort of as a page turner that then makes them think about things that they might not have expected to think about otherwise. Because I immediately became aware when I was researching this book that I was going to be asking the reader to do some complicated things and to go some complicated places with me. And I'm such a believer in the power of story, and this is a book about how we make stories. And so it felt like I needed to tell a page-turner story that then led into these complicated places. And this is one of those complicated places where I think we have to hold in our minds that this person is saying really horrifying, disturbing things. He's explaining that in that moment, he decides to explain that to him there are three kinds of pedophiles. One that's kind of just bad, just evil. Another one that's kind of just sick and doing it for attention and all that. But then he says that there was a third kind, the kind that finds true love, and that his true love was Jeremy. And that's the moment in the records when I'm reading the testimony of different people who were in that room. They didn't testify at court, but the affidavits of people who were in that room. And they say they just were horrified. He lost them. It was so terrible. And yet, I feel like if we don't acknowledge that even the pedophiles are telling stories to themselves to justify what they're doing. If we don't acknowledge that, then we're never going to maybe even get a stab at understanding what's happening. If we don't have that level of empathy to understand that, I think the hardest thing to understand is that even people who do terrible things have a narration of themselves to themselves, have a story about the world that they live in. And I think in Ricky Langley's case, and I have come to think in some ways probably my grandfather's, I think there was a sense of being trapped in who they were. And in Ricky Langley's case, I think in some moments he was more aware that he was trapped in that who he was, and doing this was terrible. He really wrestled with it. When he was in prison, he would often try to get help for it. And the records are clear on that, that he would try to get help for it. But then you have these moments where he doesn't seem to have that awareness of just how terrible it is. And he's explaining in a way that really, I think, horrifies people. Rightly horrifies people.
You talk about how when you see his tape of his confession, when you go down to clerk for the summer with a firm that specializes in death penalty cases, it made you question your opposition to the death penalty. But someone who did not question her own opposition to the death penalty, even in Ricky Langley's case, was Jeremy Guillory's mother, Lorelei.
Yes. I'm not actually sure that she didn't question it. There are conflicting accounts of how she felt about the first trial when he was sentenced to death. Later on, I think it's absolutely true that it's clear that she opposed it. And she may very well have opposed it the entire time. I don't know. It's not clearly in the records. There are these conflicting accounts. But later on, she testified for Ricky Langley at the trial. And at the second trial, I should say. There were three trials over 20 years. So the first trial, Ricky Langley was sentenced to death. The second trial, he was given a life sentence. The third one, he was given a life sentence as well. And in that second trial, which I sort of chose to focus on in the book, because of Lorelei Guillory's decision. And it's funny to me now, you know, when I talk about this book, I slide in and out of referring to the different people in the book by their first names or by their full names, because I think as a writer, I've been carrying my idea of these people in my head for so long, thinking about them, trying to understand them, and that's sort of a strange first name relationship. But of course, I don't know them, so I'm more comfortable using the full name. Certainly at that second trial, she decided to testify for Ricky Langley. And even before that trial, there was a moment where she showed up at one of the hearings to really plead with the judge to please not have this be a death penalty case, to not make her go through this again. And she did not get her wish. It was a trial for that, but then she took a stand at the trial and pleaded for his life. And I think that was so beyond brave, so incredibly brave. And she is a hero of mine for that. And yet at the same time, when I first learned about that, and still really in some ways, it was very challenging for me to think about as someone who was hurt by a pedophile and whose parents didn't stand up to that pedophile. It was really complicated for me to read that she had testified for Ricky Langley, even as I admire her for it.
And it's such a remarkable story. Someone had even produced a play.
Yes. One of the things that drew me, I mean, there were so many things that drew me to the story. So I feel like every time I say one of the things that drew me to the story, I could say that about every single thing in it. It's such a remarkable and grossing story and one that has haunted me for so many years. But one of the things that drew me to it was just, we don't really know about this case in the U.S. This case wasn't talked about much here. It was certainly talked about in Louisiana at the time, but not beyond that. And yet it is known elsewhere. There was a play called Lorelei that was based on interviews with her that aired on BBC Radio and has been produced several times in England and in Scotland and has now been produced all over the world, most recently, I think, in Pakistan.
I've noticed strange kind of trends on Book Talk. We'll have several books that seem to be thematically linked in one way or another come up at the same time. And just recently had Ann Patchett on talking about her book Commonwealth and Eden LaPucky speaking about her book Woman Number 17, in which those are both novels, but they address the concept of how art made from life affects those people portrayed in the art. And I was just wondering how the Louisiana section of the story has responded to the book and how your family has responded to the book.
So I've reached out a couple of times to Lorelei Guillory. I haven't heard back. I hope I eventually do. I don't know how she will respond to the book. It was really important to me to work off the different ways that she has told the story, because certainly for many years, it seemed to be that she very much needed to tell the story. She went on Sally Jeffsy Raphael, for example, spoke to many reporters, things like that. And I wanted to tell a story about how we make stories, like I said. And this was a story that was told so many different times and made so many different ways. And in fact, at one point in the records, there's a letter that Lorelei Guillory wrote to the American Press newspaper in Lake Charles, saying that people kept telling the story of her son the wrong way. They, you know, in thinking about the child who was murdered, they kept making him into blonde-haired and blue-eyed, like almost this angelic vision of a child. And then you have this letter from Lorelei Guillory saying, no, he was my son. He had brown eyes. You know, he was a real boy. And I wanted to kind of capture that and be very mindful that there are real people at the core of this. In my own family, it's been complicated. My family is very supportive of the book. They've known I was writing it for many years. This book took me a really long time to write. And I've talked to them many, many times about it. And they have sort of a shifting perception at all times, because for them, it's reading a story that talks about how we all made stories in our family. And of course, you know, even siblings who grow up in the same family have totally different childhoods. In some ways, grow up in totally different families, totally different ideas of their family. And so we have this kind of cluster of facts, the abuse, and many of the other things that happened in our family, you know, that are in the book. But we all have our different interpretations of it. And so it's led to a lot of long conversations and a lot of hugs and a lot of sort of shifting takes and perspectives, and is bringing about conversations even now.
I assume there'd be so many different motivations for yourself to get this down, to describe this, to make sense of this. Did you have expectations of what you'd think the effect on yourself would be when you finish this? And could you say how they differed from what actually you are feeling now?
Sure. So I was so haunted by this for years. So when I learned of Ricky Langley's case that first time, watching the video and having this emotional response to it, a number of details stayed with me. So details that are in the first part of the book, the blue Dick Tracy blanket, the BB gun, Jeremy Guillory's BB gun. Those details would come back to me for years unbidden. And yet, even as I was haunted by those details, the minute I tried to think of the man whose case this was, the man who had committed the murder, I tried to think of Ricky Langley's name. His name was gone. His name was gone from my consciousness. In those years, I could even look at a newspaper article from the case. And a minute later, as soon as I put the article down, Ricky Langley's name would be gone from my memory. And I knew this was weird, right? It's very strange to have something right in front of you, put it down, and then it's wiped, and yet the other details all haunt you. So I knew that this was kind of a haunting. And there's only one other moment in my life that's ever been like that. This moment with my grandfather, where I remember everything else about the moment in this crystal clear, vivid way. And then there's this pinprick of a black hole that took out this one super salient detail that I talk about in the book. And so I knew that these stories were linked for me, and I felt very haunted. And when I originally got part of the case record in total is some 30,000 pages, roughly. But I originally got the first 8,000 pages from the 2003 trial where Lorelei Guillory had made her plea, because I thought that what I was looking for was to just understand the facts that had happened. Like, maybe if I could nail down the facts, I wouldn't feel haunted. I wouldn't feel inhabited. I wouldn't feel like there was this massive unresolved thing inside me. And of course, if that had actually worked, if those 8,000 pages had put it all to rest inside me, there would be no book. Instead, it ushered in this larger haunting. Because what I saw in the records really surprised me. What I saw was that, far from being kind of the only person who had interpreted the case through the lens of my own past, who looked at Ricky Langley and saw my grandfather, many other people in the case had looked at it through the lens of their own families. I started to realize that this was really a layered story about how we interpret the lives of others, and, as I keep saying, sort of how we make stories out of the past. And so that kind of haunting sort of changed inside me. Then it became, okay, then I have to go deeper into these records. And I will tell you, that was not easy. So for years, you know, as you do in life, you sort of go about your life and you have these conversations and people say, what are you doing these days? You know, what are you working on? You go to the Christmas party and people say, hey, how's your year been? What you doing? And whenever I said, well, I'm working on this book and it's partially a memoir, people would say, a memoir? That must be so therapeutic. And I would think, oh my gosh, I am delving into the most painful unresolved moments in my life. And I am delving into records really dramatic things, but also very difficult things. And I am obsessed with this story. I'm spending all my time thinking about it. I wake up thinking about it. I have nightmares related to it. I am inhabited. And I am driven by this huge need to sort of take this inhabiting that's happening to me, take this hauntedness, and kind of get it on the page. I saw this story here that just felt so vivid to me. When I read the files, I saw the people in the past. And I remembered my own life so vividly. And these memories seemed so entwined to me that that was what I was driven by. Just the need to get it down. So when people said, that must be so therapeutic, I always sort of wanted to bite back. Not if you're doing it right. because in memoir, I think you got to wade toward the unresolved. It doesn't feel therapeutic at the time. So imagine my surprise when I finally held the book in my hands and I realized that having written it was profoundly therapeutic. Because all of a sudden, I made a place for the past to live, a place for all these stories that, you know, growing up, I felt so haunted by what had happened with my grandfather, but I wasn't allowed to say it. And now I made a place to say it. But then also, importantly, I think, when I first saw the tape of Ricky Langley, I saw these connections and I saw all these ways and I felt all these ways in which my past was colliding with something outside me that then started to feel like actually something that we just do in life but don't talk about in the criminal justice system. And I felt like I needed to tell this story. And so to finally have it down is really beautiful. And gosh, to talk to people about it is just amazing. I mean, right? Because you're obsessed with something for so long. And you just think, especially with the records, I mean, I was living in these 30,000 pages of records and finding all these things that seemed interesting to me, but that I could never say to somebody else, I swear this is interesting. Please come with me while we care about this obscure thing that happened in, you know, 1964. Let me tell you how striking it was. And now I sort of get to actually talk to people about this and invite them into this story and share this. So I would say that while the actual writing process was not therapeutic, having written it turns out to be this really beautiful, transformative thing.
With now the larger world who did not know you personally before the book came out, having these access to details of very painful moments of your life, and naturally when you meet readers of the book, they'll want to discuss parts of this. What's the balancing act of people having this book as the primary lens in which to see you, but also not letting the tragedy define you? How does that work?
Yeah, I mean, I hope that the book is larger than what happened in my past. There's a larger story there. And it also talks about happy moments in my own life. And I think, you know, when you're reading the book, you know that I ended up going to Harvard Law School and then I became a writer and like things worked out okay, you know? I don't know if that's why, but in a way that I'm really grateful for, the people I've talked to who've read the book mostly haven't wanted to talk about my past. They feel like they have that part of me, but that means that they feel like we've made a connection already. And they have mostly wanted to talk about their own lives and what they see in their own lives and the way that these stories resonate with them and why they resonate with them. And I am really grateful for that. It feels like a profound act of trust on their part to invite me in to their own story. And I think part of what so drove me to write this book was that I felt so alone in everything that had happened. And then I felt so alone in what I was seeing in these records, this story that I was seeing that hadn't been brought to light. And then for many years, I've been teaching writing. And in particular, I was teaching memoir for a number of years. And that meant that I was hovering over other people's lives. And I was starting to see how alone so many people felt in the things that had happened in their own lives and things that had happened in their own families. And what I'm so grateful for about writing and about, I think I've always been this way as a reader, about books, is the way they bring our stories to each other. They sort of cross the islands of consciousness. I sometimes think of us all floating around in the islands of our bodies, carrying these stories from our lives inside us, and yet we're kind of alone in them.
And but the books irony transcend of drafting that. On your own, though.
Yeah, you're drafting on your own, but then the book enters the world and becomes this thing that people get to interact with. And so the way that it's been creating opportunities for connection with people is just this really profoundly beautiful side effect that I didn't totally see coming.
Has there been thought to your next writing project?
So I seem to be drawn to this question of how we make stories out of the past. You know, here I feel like this is a story in which if I've done my job right in the book, the reader has this experience of getting to know how complicated the past was. And then they reach the trial. And the trial is actually really simple. The story is actually told in this really simple way that kind of papers over the complexity of the past. So what I kind of wanted to do was peel back these simple ways that we sometimes tell stories in the legal system and families, and I think in society, and try to make space for the complexity. But then I've been spending a lot of time in Cambodia lately, and I've been thinking a lot about the way that in the U.S., the primary ways I would say that we make story publicly about the past would be the justice system, the media, and the education system. And Cambodia is very much in a situation where all three things were kind of humming along nicely prior to the Khmer Rouge, from different degrees nicely, but, you know, humming along, and have struggled to recuperate since the Khmer Rouge. I was doing some interviews at the International Criminal Court about the way the story of the genocide is being constructed within the process of the trial and how much that does and does not resonate in Cambodian society as opposed to how it's being interpreted in the West. I had the extraordinary opportunity to sit in on some trainings for secondary school teachers in how to teach the genocide and was really struck by how much some of these kids, you know, 20, 21 years old, just in training to be a teacher for the first time and being taught how to teach the genocide, many of them were actually learning about the genocide for the first time. Some of them felt that it was a rumor prior to that point. And I started to see, oh, wait, this is a case in which those ways that we make story in society that I just sort of mentioned are actively making that story now. So I have no idea what I'm doing, because as a writer, this seems to be the way I work. I just kind of immerse myself in something for a long time, and I think maybe it's emerging into something, but I don't know. So I have an article due soon about this, but I don't know whether it's going to become something larger. I just know that I'm in that stage where I'm really curious and trying to learn. And for many years with this book, that's what it was. It was sort of, I'm in it for the research. I'm really curious and I'm trying to learn. So I don't know if it'll become anything, but that seems to be where my attention is these days.
Well, Alexandria, I want to thank you so much for stopping by today and sharing your story with us.
Thank you for having me. It's been lovely to talk about this with you.
Alexandria Marzano-Lesnovich is the author of The Fact of a Body, A Murder and a Memoir, which is published by Flatiron Books. I'm Stephen Usry, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is recorded in the studios of WIPL in Memphis, Tennessee. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at WIPLFM@gmail.com or write to us at Book Talk, care of WIPL, 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee, 38111, or call us at 901-415-2752. You can find information on upcoming tapings and broadcasts of Book Talk, as well as download podcasts at our blog, WIPLFMBookTalk.blogspot.com.
This recording of Book Talk is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license for the United States. You are free to share, copy, distribute, or display and perform this work. But there are restrictions. Nothing in this license impairs or restricts WIPL's moral rights. Thank you for listening to Book Talk.